You'd assume that the president of the United States would have a pretty full entree. So at first glance, bit of a surprise to hear Donald Trump lash out at South Africa on Sunday night, threatening to cut aid over its 2023 Employment Equity Act. Of course, there's an obvious suspicion over who did the whispering in Trump's ear. South African-born Elon Musk has been locking horns with the ANC-led government of Cyril Ramaphosa, this over its refusal to sign on to SpaceX founders' Starlink broadband via satellite system. Musk calling post-apartheid laws on black empowerment, quote, openly racist. Who wins this showdown? More broadly, are tech titans now dictating U.S. foreign policy? How much power do they wield? And as the developing world goes online more and more, who controls the personal information of all those new citizens logging on? Today in the France 24 debate, is Donald Trump doing Elon Musk's bidding? Joining us from Johannesburg, Ray Hartley, research director at the public policy think tank, the Brenthurst Foundation. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good evening.
From Abuja, the capital of Nigeria, Najima Animashaun, non-resident fellow at the African Policy Research Institute. Good to see you.
Good to be on your show again, Francois.
Alexandre Kateb is the founder of Multipolarity.ai. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your reactions on the hashtag F24 debate. Yeah, on the day when Donald Trump was taking on Mexico, Canada, China, barring staff from entering the U.S. Agency for International Development, the world was also digesting his dig at South Africa, as Charlie James reports.
It all started on Sunday with this statement from Donald Trump.
The terrible things are happening in South Africa. They're taking away land, they're confiscating land, and actually they're doing things that are perhaps far worse than that.
The U.S. president offered no proof of his claim, but threatened to cut off all funding to South Africa. Trump appeared to be reacting to a land expropriation law enacted last month by South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, one that makes it easier for the state to seize land in the public interest. The new law aims to address the gaping land ownership disparity in South Africa, a result of decades of white minority rule under apartheid. White people make up around 8% of South Africa's population, but own three-quarters of the nation's freehold farmland. In response to Trump, Ramaphosa said the South African government has not confiscated any land and that he looks forward to clarifying the land reform policy with Washington. South Africa's mineral resources minister had a tougher reaction.
And they said, let's not mobilize Africa. Let's withhold minerals to the U.S. That is it. If they don't give us money, let's not give them minerals.
Trump's interest in this issue may be coming from one of his closest allies.
Take over, Elon!
Elon Musk, who was born in South Africa. The world's richest man has also attacked Pretoria, accusing his homeland of allowing a genocide against white farmers. Trump's threat is already impacting South Africa's economy. The nation's currency, stocks, and government bonds all weakened on Monday.
Ray Hartley, did you see this coming?
Yeah, I didn't expect that it would happen so quickly and in such an aggressive manner. But it's been clear for some time, even under the previous U.S. administration, that patience with South Africa has been slowly running out. I think this particular incident is probably sparked by, well, I mean, there are two separate things. The one is Elon Musk's attempt to get Starlink into South Africa, which requires government approval. And that approval is only given if it meets the criteria that are set by black empowerment legislation. And essentially that means you've got to have a partner, a local partner in South Africa that has a 30% stake in the business. So that was not the way that Musk wanted to do business, and he said so at the time. And so I think that's the origin of the criticism of the Black Economic Empowerment legislation. And then the second thing is the passing last week of the Expropriation Act, which allows government, in certain unspecified circumstances, to take away land with zero compensation. It's been a controversial issue in the country for some time. There is a constitutional protection of property rights which would override this legislation. So I don't think it's quite as big a deal here in South Africa as it is out there. But having said that, the question has to be asked why this legislation needed to be passed if there was never no intention of ever doing this.
And what's your answer to that?
I personally think it's essentially a piece of populist political performance by Ramaphosa. He's trying to appease a faction in his party that is unhappy with his compromise with the centrists in the government, because there's now a government of national unity with the centrist DA party and IFP party being partners. And that's caused a bit of upset within the ANC and a bit of a rebellion. And I think he's trying to look radical to them, to sort of say, you know, I'm not a sellout, I'm actually pursuing these sorts of populist policies that you want. But I don't think he has any intention of implementing it. So, you know, this is the complicated thing which I think he wishes to, in some way, communicate to the US administration. Of course, the fear is that the US administration is not really listening to complicated answers right now.
Yeah, let me bring into our conversation, I want to welcome her to the show, Bulelwa Mabasa, director of the land reform practice at Werksmans Attorneys, also in Johannesburg. Thanks for joining us here in the France 24 debate.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be part of the conversation.
You just heard there Ray Hartley saying, yeah, they passed this land reform bill, makes it easier to expropriate. But it's a bit of political theater on the part of Cyril Ramaphosa to placate his left wing and a coalition government. In point of fact, Donald Trump is making more of it than South Africans are. Do you agree? Is that how you see it?
I think it's important to ground the discussion around what are South Africa's priorities in terms of its constitution. South Africa has been a nation that was born, if you like, in 1994. We've had a racial past that has been constituted by land dispossession, racial dispossession. And so our constitutional framework is grounded on specific land reform objectives. What this act does is that it formalizes what the constitution imagine that the state would do. What this act does is the Constitution of 1996 makes provision that there will be expropriation on a basis of a just and equitable compensation. Unfortunately, in South Africa, it's taken us 50 years, or rather even almost 30 years, to actually bring this legislation in line with our Constitution. So we have a constitutional framework which is part and parcel of our rule of law, is part and parcel of our common law, is part and parcel of our jurisprudence to enable the state to acquire property where it needs to for a public interest and a public purpose. And so this is a timely legislation that government was a bit late in putting into part of our constitutional dispensation. So there's nothing controversial about an expropriation, given that all governments throughout the world are able to use the expropriation powers where it's required to do so for a public purpose and in the public interest.
And does it mean that there's going to be the kind of expropriation that was seen in neighboring Zimbabwe under Robert Mugabe of white-owned farms?
Absolutely not. In fact, this legislation is actually quite blind to race, to gender. What this legislation is, it's a state power that we actually borrowed from German law, from the Netherlands, where the state is able to utilize certain land for purposes of progressing our land reform objectives. South Africa is a little bit in a unique position from the other countries in Europe and so forth, because in South Africa, we have a very unique history where in 1913, there was an act that was legislated that dispossessed Black people from their land without any compensation. This act is nothing like that. This act is a benign act that allows the government, same as America, same as the Netherlands, same as in anywhere in Europe, that allows that to happen. It has no intention of targeting any racial group, whether minority or otherwise. What it actually does, it is there to ensure that there is land justice in South Africa, but not just land justice. If South Africa, for example, needs land for renewable energy, for infrastructure, for building of roads and trains and the like, it's able to do so. What is actually interesting is that expropriation powers have been with us since time immemorial. In fact, the apartheid government also used expropriation powers. Mm. So the controversy around this bill being targeted at white farmers is actually quite misinformed and quite misguided, because this bill says where there will be no compensation will be instances where the land is not used, there's no productivity,
right,
the landowner is absent, and so forth. So the misinformation around this bill targeting specific groups in South Africa is absolutely got no legal foundation.
No legal foundation, and yet we saw Elon Musk responding to President Ramaphosa's denial of that there would be arbitrary confiscation of land by in turn tweeting, "Why do you have openly racist ownership laws?" Najim Animashaun, your thoughts on Elon Musk, who's no longer just an ordinary private citizen in the United States, weighing in so heavily.
Yes, it's one of those situations where you have to take a deep breath and not react emotionally to this. It's clearly designed to get a response, and the sheer volume of controversial actions that the Trump administration has taken has basically took us all by surprise. In the case of Elon Musk, I think this has been a slow burn for him. And for South Africa, what I see are the dangers are not so much in the denial of aid, which is approximately less than 0.1% of their GDP or their gross revenues. It's more the $14 billion of trade, that of which about a third or so of that qualifies for duty-free access under the Africa Growth and Opportunities Act. And if the Trump administration were to impose tariffs, that could have an impact, particularly in some areas that would affect quite a lot of jobs in South Africa.
What's your gut feeling, Najim? Is this just a bit of bluster, or could it go all the way down that road?
Well, I think the South African president has done his best to actually diffuse the tension as much as possible, largely because I suspect that as the chairman of the G20, he's going to be the host of the next G20 meeting. And in sometime this month or maybe next month, there is a G20 foreign ministers meeting in South Africa, which Marco Rubio is going to be there. So there isn't any reason for Ramaphosa to be combative at this stage, given the fact that there is going to be an opportunity to engage. And he basically said, "I will engage with President Trump on this issue at a later date." So he's got to be careful in this. He can't start having a verbal fisticuffs with Elon Musk, even if Elon Musk is gagging for a bite. I think for the MAGA crowd in America, this is something that is music to their ears. in that, you know, white minorities in South Africa are being persecuted, or the perception of being, being persecuted. The fact that this isn't the case, as was very clearly and articulately expressed by Bulelwa, forgive me if I've mutilated your name, is one of those situations where a technical response is completely lost on the people who are trying to make propaganda and hay out of this. So I think for Musk, this is, you know, a cheap shot, and he's got a cheap win because nobody can really punch back very, very hard.
So Alexandre Kateb, a lot of viewers are confused. Are you confused? Because on the one hand, you have transactional power plays, politics, and then thrown into it this very extremist ideology, it seems.
Well, I think I'm as much confused as anyone else, but this is not very surprising if you look at the other threats that Trump has made over the last few days, including the tariffs that were reversed just the day after, for the tariffs on Canada and Mexico, for example. Now he's negotiating with China to avoid the tariffs, and now what really puzzles me is why he chose South Africa like his next bone of contention. Why does he want to mess with South Africa? I think the answer goes beyond the case of Elon Musk or whatever. I think it's really a geopolitical play, a geopolitical strategy. You have to view it in line with this situation of tension he tries to create with China, obviously. And we know that South Africa has close links to China.
So here's the question. Is it bargaining or is it ideology?
I think it's a bargain, but in the context of a broader shift of power politics that he wants to impose over the planet. And he's choosing some of the weakest links, if you want. For example, among the BRICS countries, he aimed at the BRICS countries by saying that they should never replace the dollar with the BRICS currency, for example. And South Africa appears to be the weakest link within the country, the BRICS countries. If you look at the economy, the political governance system, etc. So he's trying to say, now things are going to change. The sheriff is in town, and now everyone will have to comply with this new world order that I'm going to impose. By the way, South Africa, just like 15 or 20 years ago, was still considered to be in the Western alliance, and it moves gradually toward China and the BRICS. And maybe one of the reasons he aims at South Africa is because he wants to maybe push back China and bring back this weakest link in the Western and American influence zone.
Ray Hartley, is that going to work? Is this going to make South Africa pay more attention to the United States, think twice before increasing its business with the likes of China and Russia?
Yeah, I think it has already worked under the previous administration. Ramaphosa has been at pains, really, to make it clear that the country is not aligning itself with one or another bloc. South Africa is in a position where it sells a lot of it's a large resource producing nation. It sells a lot of that to China. So that would be, various minerals and so on, and iron ore and coal and things like that. But then its industrial output is sold mostly to the West. So the consumers of the more high-end products produced in the economy, like there's quite a large motor vehicle manufacturing sector in the country, and those cars are exported, some of them to the United States and to Europe. So it has to play you know, it has to be in good favor with both of these blocks. It doesn't really work to pick one or the other side. And I think that the ANC began drifting towards the sort of Russia-China direction and the BRICS direction, and a little bit away from the West, certainly in terms of foreign policy and so on. And that provoked, a response. And since then, I think Ramaphosa has been trying to readjust and to try and restate that the country is neutral. And I think his chairmanship of the G20, a very high-profile diplomatic position to be in on the global stage, makes him not want to be the subject of a big global diplomatic fallout with any of the major players. I think he would like to see this year being one in which he projects himself as someone who can talk to all sides and, you know, is a statesman of some kind. And this really throws a bit of a spanner in the works for that.
Can Elon Musk blow it all up?
I do think he's driving this, certainly from the language that Trump used. And, you know, it's clear that he's talking about the issues which Elon Musk has been putting on the table. And I think the problem with Elon Musk is that he's a genuinely unpredictable character. I mean, he doesn't really need to make any more money. So he's not scrounging around for transactions or anything like that. I think he just wants to rule the world. And to sort of bully countries if necessary. So I think that's really an awkward position for South Africa to be in.
What is it, Bulela Mabasa explained this to me, what is it about, people have often asked this question, about this sort of South African streak running through Silicon Valley and tech titans? There's Elon Musk, part of what the tech world calls the PayPal mafia, the likes of Peter Thiel as well, Mark Andreessen, very powerful men who are all from South Africa. He's the most outspoken when it comes to politics. But why is there this South African sort of strain in Silicon Valley?
Look, as a lawyer and as an attorney practicing in land reform, I don't think that I can predict or even, you know, give a certain posture around, you know, South African men in Silicon Valley. But I think if I were to step a little bit outside of my expertise, I would say that there is a feeling, there is a groundswell of communities in South Africa that feel threatened around the need for South Africa to redress, to correct the injustices of the past. And the land issue is one of them, but it's certainly not the only one. South Africa still grapples with inequality that is probably the largest inequality in the world compared to other countries in the globe. Our democracy is relatively still young, and we have a very high rate of unemployment, and there's this growing groundswell of Black youth who feel that they have not had a place and a voice in the democratic era that's been built in the last 30 years, on one hand. And on another hand, you have white men who feel threatened by the constitutionally sanctioned need for equity, for equality. And so the Elon Musk voice is certainly not isolated when you have to think about other sectors of society that feel that justice equates, their privileges being taken away, or that equity means that they are kind of being, you know, put in the back burner in the democratic project. So I think really the Elon Musk voice speaks to the right-wing part of our society that has grown in the last 30 years, that feels that issues such as the Expropriation Act or even the need to reform is a direct affront to their existence.
And now there's two aspects that are at play when it comes to Elon Musk. One is, we've talked about it and you've talked about it eloquently, the land reform issue. The other is labor practices. That's where it perhaps is testing a bit, South Africa's ruling coalition. According to the Financial Times, which spoke with South Africa's communications minister, Solly Malatsi, who hails not from the ANC, but from the business-friendly Democratic Alliance Party, Malatsi points to a labor law carve-out that exists in key sectors like the auto industry, carve-outs cryptically called equity equivalence programs, where there have to be, there don't have to be as many black hires. He says, I recognize the opportunity that equity equivalence programs in the telecom sector can help in expanding broadband connectivity to the quarter of our population, which does not have access to the internet yet, while grappling with the reality that the current legislation doesn't cover for that. That's also at the heart of why Starlink didn't get its license in South Africa. Bulelo Mabasa, how should the South African government handle those labor practice laws when it comes to something that's, you know, so high tech as Starlink?
Look, I think it's a fair balance that has to be struck between ultimately economic development and the need to reform South Africa's society. And the telecoms industry is not on its own. We're faced in South Africa still with the legacy of most listed companies still being led, managed, and owned by white males. We still have the left with the legacy of black women being, kind of excluded from high economy industries. I think what this calls for is a balancing act between the need to also deal with the very growing discontent that is happening around society across industries on the need to redress, but yet at the same time, interfering with economic growth and the opportunity for job creation. So it's a very kind of delicate balance that has to be struck here. And quite incidentally, if we have to speak to, for example, the heart of our constitution, especially when we speak to Section 25 of our constitution, you find that on one hand, we have a clause that says property rights cannot be arbitrarily taken away or being deprived. And yet in the very same clause, there is an injunction, or rather an instruction or direction, that tells the state, the South African state, to ensure that there is land justice and land redistribution. So that is almost kind of an existential reality that South Africa has to face of striking the balance between the two. And I think that can be done and that can occur. What I would like to comment about is that incidences of, for example, the tweets, whether that's from Trump or Elon Musk, don't assist in that project of a reconciliation project that South Africa started in 1994. They actually add in polarizing the voices of the left and the right, and they actually amount to the conversation that we're having here today, which is not good for the country.
Not good for the country. Naji Mani Mashaun, polarizing society, pitting citizens against each other. Is it good for business? Elon Musk has Starlink licenses in neighboring Zimbabwe, Botswana, Mozambique. Ultimately, will he get a license in South Africa?
Well, I can't say whether he'll get a license in South Africa. I can't say that. Mea culpa, I'm actually using Starlink to be talking to you from Nigeria. So it's a particularly useful connectivity device because it doesn't have to
Oh, the image seems to have frozen just as he said that he was using Starlink. I don't know how that bodes. Alexandre Katter, we'll reconnect with Najim as quickly as we can.
Yeah.
Your thoughts on Starlink, because we, those who don't follow the tech world very closely, were a little surprised, remember, when Elon Musk, it turned out, had told Ukraine, you can use our Starlink satellite system. He was cheered for it, for keeping the internet on, effectively, after Vladimir Putin's full-scale invasion. But then he told him, don't use Starlink to hit Crimea. And we suddenly realized the outsized power of one man, it seems, in this conflict.
That's right, yes. I think Starlink is a fantastic innovation, and we know Elon Musk's talent for you know, creating this kind of innovations and scaling them up, as he did with other businesses. So the real issue with Starlink is that it fills a gap. It fills a gap in the kind of infrastructure that many African nations actually don't have, that would allow them.
Why isn't this
to
public?
Develop.
Why is it in the hands of
because,
one man who has this outsized
nobody,
power?
Nobody maybe had the kind of alliance of capital, connections, etc. To kind of promote and scale this project, and because we have to face it, Elon Musk is one of the most successful entrepreneurs in the world. So it's not really an issue. The issue is why so many African countries and even countries in Europe, for example, Italy, which is now turning to Musk and wants to
use Starlink for defense.
Yes, use Starlink for defense. Why all these nations actually have allowed this kind of gap in their infrastructure to grow by the time, and now they have to rely on such monopolists as Elon Musk.
Well, our Starlink connection to Abuja has been restored. Najim, maybe you have the answer to that question.
Well, I think there must be a ghost in the machine called Elon Musk. I thought I was just about to start my time on him. We've had some labor issues here in West Africa with Elon Musk, that both at ex-employees and Starlink employees. So it's not as if it's a bed of roses. The service has been quite poor. But here's the thing: if somebody's willing to invest in the technologies in a place like Nigeria and is willing to accept local currency, which is very much not convertible, right? You will get subscribers, and it is far more reliable than the telcos that provide connectivity. And in a place where almost all of the connectivity is done over the cell phone masts, and there's none that's done through broadband cable like you would have in France. So if you've got a satellite system that can give you even better service, you'd probably go for it like I have. So ultimately, it's just a matter of economics, and that's probably what makes him a remarkable businessman. In terms of his policy, reprehensible on some of the things that he says, but you have to deal with those as well.
Well, so Najim, let me ask you this, looking at the broader picture here. Africa doesn't own the internet, but with its population soaring, it's sure to become the planet's perhaps biggest provider of all the data that's worth mining by those big tech companies. Now, obviously, the continent's not there yet. We've just talked about, and you heard earlier Bulelwa talking about the gaps there are with the inequality access to internet. But here you see, for instance, a graph that shows, the steady growth in coverage of the continent. So what's the leverage that Africa has, that African citizens have, when they're talking to these tech titans that effectively are going to own their data?
It's an ongoing conversation in Nigeria and all over West Africa. Apparently, there's a saying in the tech world that if you don't pay for the product, you are the product. And given that most people in Nigeria and West Africa are on less than a dollar a day, that makes them a very attractive product if they're getting free or near free internet and internet access. So this really requires governments to take a a much more robust approach. But that also creates an asymmetry, because the capacity of governments to regulate and to keep up with the pace of technology is outpaced by the sheer velocity of technological change. So, we're at a disadvantage. But that doesn't mean that we don't have Africans in places like Silicon Valley. The vice president of Google's AI, the head guy at Google's AI, is a Zimbabwean. And there are various other people that I know that are working in at the highest echelons of these tech companies, to try and create an indigenous African version of this is really the thing. That there is enough skill, there is enough money in Africa to do it, but there's just not enough convening power to actually get that capital to coalesce. And I suppose that's really where the Silicon Valley ecosystem, as well as I think it's in India, Indian Silicon Valley ecosystem, has created a competitive advantage over what we could do in Africa. Over here in Nigeria, where we have some of the a few years ago we had about 60% of all unicorns, tech unicorns, fintechs that were created in Africa. All of them have been bought out by the bigger companies in Europe and America. So it's one of those things that is irksome, because we just don't seem to have enough convening power to be able to capitalize on this potential, on these assets. I don't know what the answer is. I think that's the analysis that I have.
How do you level the playing field, Alexandre Kateb?
Well, you level the playing field by investing in new technologies that don't have this kind of legacy. You know, the legacy tech system that is so difficult to move around. The good thing in Africa is that you can innovate from scratch, so to say, and you have very good example of successful like innovations in mobile money, mobile banking. For example, you have the MPS. System in Kenya and Eastern Africa. So actually, Africans were more advanced in fintech than Europeans or than Americans at some point. And if there is enough capital and, as has been said, enough political attention to this kind of nucleus of innovation, then it can spread over the continent. I think the real problem is the fragmentation also of the African continent, and the fact that you have these egos all around, the politicians that cannot put their resources together. So we have this transcontinental free trade agreement that was passed before COVID, and I think there was a lot of hope about this agreement materializing into something on the ground. And now I think it's up to the leaders in Africa, to make sure that this turns into reality in terms of jobs, investments, especially for the youth.
Unfortunately, leaders in Africa often at loggerheads. Case in point, right now there seems to be scramble for the precious metals needed for the digital age. Many of those can be found in the ground of Eastern Congo, where there are both South African troops on the side of Kinshasa and rebels backed by Rwanda. In an interview with CNN, Rwanda's president doubling down on his sharp criticism of his South African counterpart.
People who are benefiting from minerals of Congo more than anybody else are South Africa and these other Europeans who are making noise about it.
Second time this week, inside of a week, Ray Hartley, where Paul Kagame has directed his ire at Cyril Ramaphosa. Again, is this also a sign of the times?
Yeah, I think this is more a sign of the disorganized state of South Africa's military, because a large force was sent there, but without sufficient air cover, and without the sort of wherewithal to see off a properly organized assault, which is what took place. And so far, I think 14 South African soldiers have died there. As to the allegation that those soldiers are protecting South African assets and resources, I don't think there's really any evidence for that. I think there are South African mining companies with interests there, as there are from all over the world. But it would be, I'm not sure that there's a connection with the troops. I think that's much more of a, again, an effort to try and project South Africa in global diplomacy as a force. But it was done without the proper wherewithal and has had some pretty tragic consequences.
And one quick final question on this, Ray Hartley, because we're running short on time. Is this a moment where everybody's suddenly awakening, like we are in Europe, to basically where the power plays lie with the digital economy, with the digital age?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening. I think that power has been accumulating quietly in the what's called the tech bros, really, in the US. And now it's reached a sort of critical mass, and it's exploded into political territory. So I think it's, whether or not that's going to be a force for good and innovation and drive more and better technology, or whether it'll be used for malign purposes is not clear at this point.
Ray Hartley, I want to thank you so much for joining us from Johannesburg. I want to thank Bulelo and Mabaso also for being there, as well as Najima Anima Shaun in Abuja. Alexandre Kateb, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
Доброго дня.
A rising death toll, soldiers going AWOL or draft exemptions. The Ukrainian army is shrinking.
Досить багато вже людей, які формили собі.
Тоді, коли була оця от сполученість людей, патріотизм, це люди хотіли йти воювати. Зараз просто час пройшов, корупція може.
A war of attrition, where losses far outweigh new recruits.
У нас напала Росія. Здається, що навіть мене судять не за СЗЧ, а за сміливість сказати дещо військові це не радить. Якщо ми будемо сьогодні воювати стомленою піхотою,
Ukraine's efforts to rebuild its army may be running out of steam. Reporters on France 24 and France24.com. Special events. Paris, the global hub of AI. On February 10th and 11th, the world's leading AI players will gather at the Grand Palais. Heads of state, industry leaders, researchers, and representatives from NGOs. For the first time, they will outline the actions needed to develop AI that upholds universal values. The Artificial Intelligence Action Summit. Watch this exclusive event on February 10th and 11th on France 24.